welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week from 10 a.m. till midday New Zealand time, and excuse me, 3 till 5 p.m. Pacific, 5 till 7 Central, 6 till 8 p.m. Eastern, and 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time. And I just got finished editing a video last night, and you know what? I actually am the funniest protest march leader chanter that exists, I reckon. It's just freaking classic, you know? There's something about a megaphone that just makes you funnier, you know? Especially if you're being unconventional with it. Now, speaking of unconventional or UFO conventional, we have a very special guest today, ladies and gentlemen, a man who is well known throughout the UFO community. His name's Richard Dolan. He's one of the most well-known names in modern ufology, being perhaps the world's leading researcher and historian on the UFO subject. He's the author of 2 information-packed volumes of UFO history, UFOs and the National Security State, volumes 1 and 2, as well as an analysis of the future in a book called AD After Disclosure, when the government finally reveals the truth about alien contact. He is a regular guest on Coast to Coast AM radio, and he's appeared on many television specials for the History Channel, Sci-Fi, BBC, and elsewhere. Since 2012, Richard has hosted his own internet radio show, The Richard Dolan Show, which airs on KGRA Radio Saturday evenings from 8 till 11pm Eastern. Right, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinny. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, likewise, bro. And what I also wanted to ascertain from you is sort of how you personally kind of got into this particular field. Everybody got a story. I was like to hear yours.
We've all got a story. I have mine. Man, I'm getting old now. I started doing this about 20 years ago. And back in those days, I was simply working on a doctoral dissertation in history. I figured my life was going to be teaching at a university, probably doing some kind of Noam Chomsky-like radical history teaching at some school. That was basically my path right there. And had nothing to do with flying saucers, nothing with UFOs, and nothing even really with major conspiracies. Just sort of kind of a standard critique of American policy, I guess. And then I stumbled into the UFO field. I was in a bookstore. I found one of the real classic UFO books of all time by Timothy Good, Above Top Secret. And it was always a subtitle that got my attention. And I'll never forget. It was The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up. And I will admit, I was intrigued. And I'll never forget, till the day I die, just flipping through that book for the first time, having no idea, no knowledge of UFOs, but recognizing a lot of the names in that book from my own study, my own research. And I just thought, you know, what's the deal? How is it that these look like they're real quotes from real people who seem like they're actually interested in UFOs, and yet in the academic world, this is a non-topic, doesn't exist. There's something wrong here. As a discrepancy. And that was really what got me started. That was, I think, 1993. I bought the book and I couldn't put it down. Started lurking around on what was then the internet. Looked for some UFO-related news groups and just learned and learned and learned. And the next thing I knew, I was obsessed. Totally obsessed. Trying to figure out, not were even UFOs real. I wasn't there yet. I was at a very conservative place. I just wanted to know, is this something that's part of my country's history, part of world history? If it was, how come it hasn't been written about? Is there really a cover-up? And you know how it is. One question just leads to another and to another. And that was 20 years ago. I've been digging into this field ever since.
Problem when you don't get given answers, it just leads all the questions to more questions. And right. eventually you start to find answers, don't you? Can you recall a specific time where you actually began to get clarity about what the UFO cover-up agenda was truly about? Where you start to really come to some understanding, where the questioning sort of started to slow down. You're like, wait, hold on a second. I see what's going on here.
Yeah, I think for me it was encountering released, declassified U.S. government documents. That's what really... Because that had been the one thing that I was trained to know how to read and to accept as valid evidence rather than just plain old witness testimony. Not that that doesn't mean anything. But when you get a declassified document from the U.S. Army or from the CIA that says essentially, yes, this is something that concerns us. We don't really know what we're dealing with. And there are such documents that exist. I encountered those fairly early on in my research. One of the famous ones that I think a lot of researchers know, but even today a lot of general public don't know, is famously called the Twining Memo. And it's named after a three-star U.S. general, a guy named Nathan Twining, back in 1947. He went on to get his fourth star later. He was a big shot. And Twining, in September of 1947, writes a letter to another general. This general had asked him, hey, what's up with all these flying saucers? Do I really have anything to worry about? Is this something that we're doing, or is this an actual thing? That was basically the question. And Twining's answer was a three-page memo, single-space type memo. And what he said, incredibly, was, no, it doesn't look like ours. These are things that we don't know what they are. Our military is encountering them. And then he listed a bunch of specific qualities that these objects had, like silent, disc-shaped, evasive maneuvers when encountered. And here's my favorite, actually when he described the shape in detail, domed on top, flat on the bottom. Now, ask yourself, what's supposed to exist in 1947 that's supposed to look like that, behave like that? You have a three-star general telling another general in a classified memo, no, we don't know what the hell these are. So, yes, that moment when I really dug into that memo, that was an early moment in my research, and I thought, did they ever stop being interested in this? I mean, did they ever come up with an explanation? Another logical question. And as you go through the literature, you go through the history, the answer is no, not really. They told the public many times during the 40s and 50s that there's nothing to this, nothing to see here, go on about your business, you know. But then you find in the classified discussions that were going on, no, nothing was solved at all. They were still having the same perplexed discussions, still debates, still people in the military who really thought we were dealing with extraterrestrials, by the way. That was constantly a thread in these discussions that we have access to of the 1940s and 50s. So really, what I found is that this is the most fascinating topic I could have ever stumbled into. And by the way, I stayed within the world of academia for at least a year or so after I became obsessed with UFOs. And for a while, I would bring my UFO research into the university library. And I had to be so careful. I didn't want anyone to see, God forbid, that I had a UFO book. And it was almost literally worse than having pornography. It would be like you'd be better off having a porno in the university library than a UFO book, because they think you're crazy if you have a UFO book there.
They'd think you were an academia nut.
Absolutely.
As opposed to a macadamia.
As opposed to a macadamia. Exactly. But I stayed in that world for about a year, wondering, or not wondering, but thinking, this is crazy because I'm dealing with two versions of reality. An official version of reality where the UFOs aren't supposed to exist, where they don't exist. And then this other reality that as I dug further and further in, I realized looked pretty real to me. And so we have this, like, it was like a schizophrenic reality, official truth and unofficial truth.
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty well said. A schizophrenic reality. I call it the topsy-turvy world, where basically everything that's stated by an official source, you can basically assume that it's the direct opposite of what they're stating it is, and you'll 99% of the time be correct.
As crazy as that might sound to someone, I'm actually living that same dream as you are. You have to assume that deception is the rule, not the exception.
Yeah, yeah. Deception is not the exception. In fact, I'm going to put that into a song.
That's good. Yeah, just came up with a good liner, yeah.
Yeah. we'll continue on with that vein. Now, in terms of the huge, huge quantity of interviews, books you've read, appearances, public engagement speeches, you know, that kind of thing. Do you have any conclusions about what the UFO phenomenon actually means for human civilization? Or are you still trying to work out the nuts and bolts of it?
No, I have conclusions. Let's call them provisional conclusions. I always try to separate what I absolutely know from what I think I know. That's a very important thing to do. So one thing I'll never try to do is to pretend to you or to anyone that I have definite conclusions when what I have really instead are just good ideas. There are certain things I know. Here's what I know. There is a phenomenon that does exist that is that has been observed by military personnel around the world, including New Zealand, including Australian and everywhere else, that involves objects that behave in ways that are not supposed to be possible. And this has been going on for at least since World War II. In fact, when you really go back through history, if you want to forget the military part of it, you've got some really good reports that go even much farther back than that, really back into the 19th century and before. And if you really want to get into some interesting stories, there's some good ones that go back to ancient times. But let's leave those for a moment. We've got a very, very strong case throughout all of the 20th century that there's something happening. We have military documents proving that they're interested. So that's enough for a day's work to just say to the mainstream media, to say to the political institutions, someone's got something that's not supposed to exist that's extraordinary. What do I think is happening? I think that there are non-humans that are interested and engaged with humanity here on planet Earth. I think that Earth and human civilization is a fascinating place for them to check out. I think that humanity just about leap into their world with our own technological revolution is something that they're very, very interested in right now. And that's probably why there are multiple groups that are here. I would go further, and I would say that there are some groups that, for whatever reasons, are abducting or taking some human beings and they are returning them. I think that they're probably doing implants of one sort or another. I think the evidence on this is becoming pretty good. And that they probably have a permanent presence here and don't really have much interest in being openly acknowledged. They have their business here and it doesn't really involve them shaking hands with you and me as openly having diplomatic relations with humanity. That's my guess. I think they're eons ahead of us and we really are struggling just to be able to understand, much less keep up with what they're all about.
So not only are the humans covering up that the UFO phenomenon is happening at the highest levels, but also the ETs themselves are covering up their appearances as much as they possibly can. And it's been happening since ancient times. So one would lead to the conclusion that they don't ever plan on revealing themselves to humanity unless they're forced to.
That's my opinion. And what I think is happening, and when I wrote AD After Disclosure with Bryce Zabel, our conclusion was that there will be a disclosure. Actually, my conclusion was disclosure is a paradox. It's impossible, but it's inevitable. In one sense, it's impossible because there's really no motivation for the powers that be or even for these other beings to reveal themselves. But it's inevitable because the big thing that's changing in this equation is actually us, our society. We're not the way we were 100 years ago, 200 years ago, even 10 or 20 years ago. We are going through some kind of major revolution. And we're not done with that revolution. So what I actually think is happening is they are probably aware that we're getting to a point where in 20 years from now, we're going to have computers that will be incredibly intelligent and that won't need sleep. We're going to have nanotech that's off the charts. We're going to have quantum computing. We're going to have all of these other capabilities that are about to come online that actually are going to give ordinary people incredible tools with which probably to engage these other beings. And so what I think is there will be a disclosure, but only when the political powers are, and maybe these other beings, are pressed to the wall to acknowledge it.
What do you feel about Wernher von Braun saying that one of the last things that will happen before we usher in a world government is a false flag alien invasion?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I just saw Carol Rosin a couple of days ago at Joshua Tree, California, and it's Carol Rosin who is the person who has made this statement many times, and she's been quoted quite a bit about this. She was von Braun's personal secretary during his final few years of life in the 1970s. So I'm sure that he said this to her. The question that I have often asked myself is...
Oh, yeah. Tonight we're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday. And Wednesday night is the night that we usually...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. You can check out the archives at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. My associate producer, Mal Ryan, has been getting us a huge quantity of guests talking about the paranormal, aliens, djinn, psychopaths, archons, and all of this other kind of stuff. So there's huge quantities, very, very interesting interviews there for you to listen to. And if you want to listen to them commercial free, if you're savvy, you can find them on the website. But, you know, preferably it'd be lovely if you could donate something, because, you know, we're not getting paid by advertisers or the network or anything like that in order to do the show. It's all completely volunteer, and we've got to pay the bills somehow. And the way I figure it, I'm serving humanity, and if humanity rewards me for it, I think that sounds like justice, you know? Isn't that the kind of world we want? Now, speaking of the world we want, Wernher von Braun, the man we want to know about, was he correct? Or, and again, this is based on the testimony of Carol Rosin, his assistant back in the 70s, that there would be three wars. The first war would be a Cold War with the Russians. They would hype those up in order to take people's liberties and rights away from them. Then they would hype up terrorism in order to take people's liberties and rights away from them. And then when basically liberties and rights are almost gone entirely, then they'll stage a false flag alien invasion, and then everybody will go, oh, we're humans, they're aliens. Let's have a human one world government to fight the aliens that don't freaking exist. That is at least what some of the testimony kind of breaks down to. And I wanted to get your opinion on this, because we were talking over the break about how it would be a logistical nightmare in order to pull off a global alien invasion scare.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what I said. That's what I believe. You know, there's a name that's often that goes with this type of idea. It's often called Project Bluebeam. And I think to pull off, there are false flags that happen all the time. I'll go to my grave saying that 9/11 was a false flag. I've said it publicly many times. There are all kinds of false flags that governments do, particularly my government, the United States government, has done for generations. So we can't expect it ever to be truthful, particularly on major geopolitical events like wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and whatnot. Those are all lies. Or the pretenses are lies and so on. But of an alien invasion, that's a different order of magnitude altogether. How do you do it? How do you Do you actually get your own fleet of flying saucers and start blasting buildings out from, you know, from where they stand using your fake alien technology? And then through that, you convince scientists? That's a really tough sell. You've got scientists around the world who aren't just skeptical of UFOs, but they are irredeemably hostile to the idea. And it's just not going to be the easiest thing in the world to just roll over the scientific community without showing some kind of real evidence rather than scaring the hell out of them. It seems to me much more likely that there'll be, if you're going to have false flags, they don't really need that to establish a totalitarian global police state. They're already on the way to doing that. You don't need a fake alien invasion for that.
Well, hold on a second. I'm wondering here, though, because false flags, as soon as they happen now, Boston bombing or the right. Sandy Hook shooting and so on and so forth, the alternative media exposes them instantly now. Maybe an alien invasion is kind of like the ace up their sleeve. Ha-ha, they'll never see this coming.
Well, I suppose. I find it to be a very, very difficult sell. And I cannot imagine how you would be able to continually pull it off. So even if you have like a week of alien invasion, it's alien invasion week now on planet Earth. Okay, so you're going to have alien invasion year. At a certain
it'll
point...
It'll be like Black History Month.
People will be... Exactly, but people will be waiting for like, hey, where are the aliens? And if they don't show themselves, you're going to have some explaining to do. It just seems to me that it's an unrealistically difficult
hurdle. Maybe by the time people are wondering, you know, are there real aliens, you know, why don't they show themselves kind of thing, by that time everybody's rearranged into a world government and tossed into the extermination FEMA camps. And it won't matter what evidence they demand because they'll be dead.
It's already happening. You don't really need an alien invasion to try to implement a global police state. It's already happening.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
They can do it through fear of all types of things. Just going back to the Wernher von Braun statement that Dr. Carol Rosen has talked about for many years, as I mentioned to you before the break, I know Carol, and I just saw her a couple of days ago in the California desert at an event that we were both at. I really like her. I respect her. I certainly believe her when she says that von Braun said this to her. But it doesn't – you have to keep in mind, he would have said this in the mid-1970s. So that's what? That's almost 40 years ago. So I'm to believe, all right, von Braun did have access to classified and UFO-related material. I believe that. So that's fair enough. But did he actually know all aspects of the game plan? Did he really? And did that game plan actually extend out for 40 to 50 years of trajectory? I don't know. I mean, it's very possible he was just giving her his opinion, which is fair enough. I don't really know if I would be able, in good conscience, to take that as gospel. And I'm saying this because so many people do. So many people do. They're like, I hear this around again and again. Oh, well, von Braun said it, so it's got to be true. And the fact is,
there could be all kinds of ways of interpreting. A Nazi scientist said it, therefore it must be true.
Exactly.
Are you listening, people?
Well, von Braun's Nazi credentials, I want to be fair to the man, are, you know, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. He did work for the Nazis. But basically, during World War II, if you didn't work for the Nazis and they wanted you, you were toast. You really had no choice. He did work at Peenemünde doing the rockets and the V-2 rocket and so on. He also worked in the U.S. for many, many years. And, you know, there were a lot of unrepentant Nazis brought aboard by the U.S., but I never had the feeling that von Braun was one of those types. So I'll give the man that much credit.
Did he ever issue public apologies or statements or something like that? Like, I'm sorry, my rockets blew up half of London, etc.?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Vinny. And the truth is, I don't know if he did.
No, if we don't know that he did, I think that would be pretty common knowledge. He probably didn't.
Maybe he didn't want
the American people knowing that he was part of Operation Paperclip and had a false identity and was hijacked from the Nazi regime to come over here and head up NASA.
Well, he never came over with a false identity, to my knowledge, but like a lot of Nazis did. State Department, CIA changed a lot of those documents. Von Braun famously came over with a big cast on his arm. There's lots of pictures of him. I actually know a woman who is a Canadian citizen, wonderful lady, who came over from Germany as a baby, as an infant, and her family knew Von Braun. And she told me, she has a photograph, she's never shown it to me, but I believe her, a picture of Von Braun in his cast holding her basket at one point. So I think, I mean, Von Braun's identity was known. There were a lot of Nazi scientists who came over very secretly, but not so with Von Braun. His identity was very openly acknowledged.
Unlike the MK Ultra scientists that wound up heading up the programs in the CIA.
Those are horrific. I wrote a little bit about MKUltra in my very first book of UFOs in a National Security State. And my God, if you ever really wanted a lesson in depravity by the United States government, just look into the history of MKUltra and what they were trying to do through the 1940s and 50s and 60s and beyond. It really never truly stopped. The name of the program changed. Various departments got involved and others didn't get involved. But the whole idea of controlling, harnessing the human mind and spirit. This was absolutely critically important for these guys. You know, back in the 1950s, the CIA had a monopoly, a world monopoly of possession of LSD. You can imagine. LSD had only been invented just before the Second World War. And right after the war ended, the CIA got it. And they said, this could be are a real key in our war over the human mind. And they thought they could use this as an interrogation tool, maybe a truth serum, who knows what. And all through the 1950s, there were CIA agents who were actually tripping specialists. And that's what they did. Their job was to experiment with acid. Famously, there was a case of an American scientist, a guy named Frank Olson, back in 1953, whose drink was spiked without him knowing with LSD. And Olson had, he was a brilliant, basically a biowarfare specialist. And he had a bad, bad trip. Eventually, CIA handlers took him to a hotel in New York City where he ended up suiciding, we're told, out of the 10th floor of the hotel. We're told that this 25-year-old, big, tough, burly guy couldn't guard against little geeky, skinny Frank Olson, and that Olson just ran through a plate glass window in the hotel to his death. What I think happened is that Olson was thrown out of the window because he was a security risk. But who knows? His family sued for damages and never really got justice. But the things that they would do, sensory deprivation experiments, I mean, just for the longest period of time, people would go crazy with some of these mind control experiments under MKUltra. Super secret. Last thing I'll say about it, because it's relevant with UFOs, it's relevant with a lot of secrecy, is that to this day, we only know about MKUltra by accident. By accident, Vinny. In other words, we could just as easily to this day know really nothing about MKUltra. Because what happened is that in the early 70s, the American president, Richard Nixon, told his CIA director, Richard Helms, you're fired. I'm giving you a month to clear out your desk. Helms knew all the secrets, and he knew about MKUltra, and he basically panicked. And he told the guy directing MKUltra, destroy all records. And that guy did destroy most of the records, but not all of them. And it was because they didn't have enough time. It was only 1 month. Had he had a little more time, had they been a little more deliberate, they could have destroyed really all trace of MKUltra, and then all we would have to this day would be rumor, no proof. Just like a lot of aspects of the UFO phenomenon, we have pretty good knowledge, but we don't have an official acknowledgement.
This sounds a lot, I watched a documentary last night called Someone Else's Country. It's a documentary about New Zealand and how we got sold out to the New World Order, essentially. And we changed our voting system from first past the post, like you got in the United States at the moment, to MMP, where you got a number of different parties that are allowed to come in. And Treasury, who have been the ones who are advising and basically setting the economic policy for the New World Order in New Zealand, the day that MMP and parties that weren't already part of the fold started to come into Parliament, Treasury employees were called into work early that morning to start shredding documents, and they didn't stop until almost every single document was shredded.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah. Isn't this what happens? The government does two things with documents: keeps them on everything, or destroys them in the case that they're damaging, that people might find out about it.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. It's disheartening. It's sad that this happened in New Zealand, which I do think worldwide still has a reputation for being this kind of wonderful paradise type of a place. I've met a number. Well, hey, I'm an outsider, dude. What do I know? But I have met a few people.
Here's what you know. America is the home of the free and the land of the brave, and you know that's a lie, and it's complete opposite of whatever they say it is. People say that New Zealand's a land of opportunity, a land of milk and honey, a land of freedom, a land of choice. It's the direct opposite of everything they say it is, too. So you know just as much about New Zealand as the average New Zealander does, because you know that most things are a lie.
Thanks for the tip. I'll still look forward to visiting your country sometime.
Yeah, man. We've got good sandwiches here.
Well, great. So we certainly agree on the nature of the lies and of deceptions and of the difficulties that ordinary people are going to have in penetrating the truth. And, you know, for me, I often, you know, wonder why do I want to focus on the UFO aspect of it? There's any number of other conspiracies, any number of other things I could be working on. And in fact, I do. I mean, I don't just really confine myself to UFOs, but on the other hand, that's really the thing that I know best. And so I do try to go with my strengths. I do feel the UFO cover-up is extremely important. I think that a lot of other conspiracy analysts really underrate it. I certainly think that a lot of the students of, even the few students of Black Budget America, don't appreciate just how important the UFO cover-up is in the creation of the black budget system that we have. In fact, I would say it's fundamental. And beyond that, I think that when you really explore all facets of the UFO phenomenon, and it has just grabbed hold of me and pulled me in to its clutches, it transforms your worldview in really significant ways.
Yeah. I think that's a good point to go to break on. Changing your worldview in really significant ways. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, when was the last time your worldview was challenged and changed? Huh? You know, I think that I don't like going more than a month or two. Maybe 6 months is about as much as I can tolerate not having my worldview radically changed. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. And my very special guest is Richard Dolan. Now, I wanted to get into this UFO conference that you were just recently in, Contact in the Desert UFO conference, and there's a huge quantity of very, very top-level exopolitical researchers and whatnot. Well, I've got a whole list of them here. Michael Sella, Jim Mars, Travis Walton, Carol Rosen, Laura Eisenhower, David Sarita, Michael Tellinger, David Wilcock, William Henry, Michael Cremo, James Gilliland, Roger Lear, Alfred Weber, and Paolo Harris, and many others. And I'm just wondering, is there behind-the-scenes conversations that happen between... I know that I have behind-the-scenes conversations with other radio show hosts, the things that don't normally go out on air. Then we have really interesting things. And I was wondering, what kind of things do UFO researchers talk about behind the scenes that they don't normally come out with on air? I mean, if that's not a difficult question.
No, that's a great question. Glad you asked it. There's always conversations that I'll have with different researchers that are usually off the cuff or usually in private. One of my favorite people that I like to get together with is Jim Mars. Jim was at the conference, and we're pretty good friends. I'm trying to think who I actually had long conversations with in terms of like other researchers. I chatted a bit with Michael Tellinger of South Africa this time. I hadn't really had a long talk with Michael before, but I had a very good conversation with him. But I'm really trying to think, in this conference, was there a lot of behind the scenes, like deep talk? What really happens, it does happen. Not so much at this particular conference, but you'll often get researchers that will share different stories with each other pretty much on the down low, just like, I'll tell you this thing confidentially, and you tell me that thing confidentially. That does happen. I think I did have a conversation or two with... I'm trying to think. Most of the good conversations I had last weekend were with attendees. And here's the thing about these conferences. I always learn more from the attendees, I feel, than they can ever possibly learn from me. I'm in a lucky position where I've gathered together a lot of information, and I have a lot of it in my head, and I can remember things very well. I've got a good memory for UFO information, and I try to put it all together in a way that makes sense, so people tell me that they like that. That said, people will come into these conferences with tremendous amounts of information that they want to share with someone, whether it's an amazing sighting or encounter experience that they've had, and you get a lot of that, or whether it's someone who has had access to some very, very sensitive information. One thing I guess that I'll mention is I had a conversation with one person. I have to be a little bit vague on this, but who told me of a very, very good source of his that dealt with two types of things. One is off the charts, off the charts technology that we have a few scientists now looking at that are, we're talking nanotechnology that is beyond anything we can imagine. That was one. And then another, having to do with underground facilities, clandestine underground bases and facilities that I was chatting with this individual about. And all of it is very consistent with other types of research that I've been doing over the years. But I guess, long story short, yes, there are definitely private conversations that take place at these. And often that's really more interesting to me than any of the public stuff that I do. This particular one, though, I'm not trying to get out of answering, and I'm not really thinking of deep conversations that I had with some of the other researchers. I chatted nicely with Jim Mars, chatted a little bit with George Norrie. Tellinger, I really, really enjoyed meeting with him, and I finally got a very good, strong handle on just why his work is so important. I think I've become a fan of Michael Tellinger. And this is a guy who, what he does is he analyzes stone circles in South Africa. These are ancient stone circles that, you know, in his own view, he ties it in together with the research of Zachariah Sitchin, who's another one who he's deceased now, but Sitchin did a lot of work analyzing ancient Sumerian cuneiform tablets and basically argued that humanity was the creation of the race of extraterrestrial god beings known as the Anunnaki and created a slave race of humanity in southern Africa to mine for gold. And Tellinger believes that these very, very bizarre stone circle formations that he has been investigating may in fact be related to that. And I thought, you know what? You've got some pretty interesting research there. So we'll take a look at it. This conference, in a lot of ways, is a little bit off the beaten path from the kind of thing that I normally do, Vinny. This is a very New Agey conference. I'm not saying that I have no sympathy for that type of a perspective, but there is a lot of lectures on kind of raising your frequency and your vibration. This is not really a language that I normally employ in my own work. So there is that whole aspect of it, which was very wonderful and lovely, but it's just not really what I do. And there was, you know, a certain amount of it, which I would say was very political and dealing with conspiracies and things like that, which are the kind of stock and trade that I like to work with. I enjoyed the conference, though, and it was very nicely designed and set up. And the last thing I guess I could say about it is I didn't feel like I was trapped in a prison hotel, which is what most of these are like. This was sort of a nice open space, more like a campus out in the California desert in a very, very pleasant environment. Good place to be for a weekend. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, it's always good to be around other people who are respected researchers and so on and so forth, because usually it's just about friendliness and having fun, and you realize that everybody's really human. What I found is very interesting is a lot of listeners to big shows and what have you, they come to idolize hosts, they come to idolize researchers, and then when they come up and speak to you, they have this idea in their head of what you are and how you think and what have you, and they almost treat you like you're not just another human, just like them, kind of thing, like you're a cut above or whatever, and the reality is far different from that. It's just, you know, we're just doing different things with our lives to most people.
Exactly right, and I get treated like that. I won't lie. I won't hide the fact that there will be people who come up to me and they treat me with this. It's nice to get respect. Don't get me wrong, but I emphasize this, and I did it all last weekend. I did it on stage and I did it in person. I said, "Look, I'm not above you. I'm not above anybody. We're all in this together. We all have to support each other. I have to support you as much as I want you to support me. We have to share information." And for my part as a researcher, this is a very important part of my philosophy. It's that I never, ever want to put a reader or a listener into a position where they have to trust me, like trust my information. In other words, everything that I research, everything that I do ought to be, at least in theory, searchable by you. Everything that I put out there should be amenable to a fact check. And you should have the ability to prove or disprove everything that I say. If I start going out there with one inside source after another, basically what that means implicitly is I'm putting myself above you and I'm saying, trust me, I'm a little bit better because I got these cool people who are giving me all this information. And I don't really like that. I don't like rolling that way. And I don't think that's a very productive way for this community of ours to move ahead, because we're already on the fringe. And we have to respect each other, work together. And that means we have to be rigorous in our data so that 99% of the information that I work with is publicly available, whether through government archives or through other people's research and through my own analysis. But I don't almost ever toss out information that someone else, such as yourself, can't, at least in theory, be able to fact check or look into. There have been a few individuals I've spoken to that have come to me on conditions of anonymity and privacy who have told me some pretty earth-shattering things. And every time that I get something like that, I mean, I have to be careful with how I treat it. I never want to overdo that sort of aspect of it, but it does happen. There are such people.
All right, well, we're coming into a break now. Now, when we come back, we want to talk about abductions. Now, we've had a number of people on the show, Rosemary Allen Guiley, Eve Logan, James Bartley, just to name a few. Many people have come forward saying that they've been abducted, whether that be by aliens or trans-dimensional beings or black ops, etc. And whatnot, and we wanted to get your thoughts about what these operations actually mean whether or not they're really going on, in your opinion. So, Richard Dolan is my guest, ladies and gentlemen. Hour number two coming up after the break. Visit the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You can listen live there, you can join in the chat room, and you can also listen and download the archives there too. Back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere.